Welcome to Westerns with Dad. This is Matt.
And this is Dad.
And on this episode, we'll be talking about Jubal from 1956. This is a Glenn Ford Western, starring Glenn Ford and Ernest Borgnine and Rod Steiger, directed by Delmer Daves.
Who 310 to Yuma.
Yeah, from 310 to Yuma fame. A film I liked immensely and was... hadn't really seen before we spoke about it for this podcast, and so I was excited to try another Delmar Daves film. He was new to me. Dad knew he was really good before, though. this is a film that has been requested over email a couple times now. Jubal has, and I want to thank you for that recommendation. That is something you can do by writing us at our email, westernsatdad@gmail.com. And, yeah, so now we're going to talk about Othello in the West, or as this has sort of come to be known. As it turns out, that's not quite it, but, I mean, you can see the Othello in the West stuff in it. Yeah.
I think that's your basic jealousy.
Yeah. What is your, how did you come to Jubal originally, Dad?
I guess I saw it on TV once.
Yeah.
A long time ago. I never saw it in the theater. Mm-hmm. I saw it on TV and thought it was pretty good. I love the cast.
Yeah.
I've always had a problem with Rod Steiger.
Oh, okay. Okay. This is interesting. Yeah.
I think he does a good job, but I think he's misguided in his accent. it just sounds weird.
Rod Steiger plays the Iago character in this, a ranch hand named Pinky, and yes, I was doing some research, or reading what other people thought, at least, on Jubal, and a common refrain is that Rod Steiger is out of place. I gotta say, I thought he was, like, my favorite thing in the movie. I thought he was awesome, actually.
I thought he did a good job. It's just the accent threw me, you know?
I like the accent. I like the
voice. Did you really?
Man, Jubal. What are you thinking about, Jubal?
He smells of sheep dip.
He's so hateful in this. He's such a bad guy in this movie. He's a really hissable villain. Uh-huh. And yeah, I like the voice. I didn't say nothing. I'm just asking you what you think there. Ship, it's a weird voice, but it works for the character. I believe this character, Pinky. It worked for me. We'll talk more about him, I'm sure. So what this is this is the story of a wandering cowboy drifter named Jubal Troop, which is quite a name, played by Glenn Ford, who sort of literally stumbles into a position at a prosperous ranch, headed by a sort of a gregarious landowner played by Ernest Borgnine, doing a real Ernest Borgnine performance. And Ernest Borgnine's got himself like a young wife, and she's kind of not so into him, there is chemistry between her and Jubal, and Rod Steiger takes advantage of this. To turn him and Ernest Borgnine against each other, in a nutshell. So, kind of Othello-ish, if Othello weren't about Othello or Iago, but rather about Cassio, the guy that is a third lead in it. Oh, by the way, I have a bad cold, so excuse me and my cold voice for this episode. Sorry about that. I really am. It's kind of a well-regarded film at this point. It has very good reviews. Everything I saw about it online was very positive. The first time I had ever heard of this was when I bought you the Criterion Edition Blu-ray.
Which is beautiful, by the way.
I bet it looks great. It's all these old movies look great when they clean them up. I did not see a cleaned up version of this. I streamed it. It looked all right.
It's gorgeous.
Well, Criterion does really good work with in that regard, and also they pick really good films to do for the most part. So I'm sure that this looked terrific. And I felt fairly confident it'd be an interesting film at least. What with the Criterion selection.
Right.
I just randomly selected it because I was like, oh, it's a Western with Glenn Ford. I bet Dad will be okay with that. And and you knew exactly what this movie was, though. You were familiar with Jubal.
It came out at a time when a lot of classic Westerns were being made. 1956 was the year The Searchers came out, for example.
Oh, wow. Okay. That's right.
And a lot of the Jimmy Stewart Westerns were coming out about that time. Just some really good Westerns being made. That was the 50s was the decade for Hollywood Westerns.
Yeah, you think? I mean, I guess that's true. Yeah, it's...
Well, for the old Hollywood Westerns, you know?
Yeah.
40s wasn't bad either, but, Stagecoach kind of got it started in 1939, and it just kind of jump-started and got it going from there.
Yeah, well, this is right in the heart of studio Western land. Yeah, this looks that way. You know, it has a very distinct vibe. It's shot in color, which was not always the case at this time, but it's really taking advantage of that color. A lot of good location shots, shooting. I mean, it looks like California for sure, but it's still...
Well, it's Grand Tetons.
Oh, it is? Okay.
Yeah. In the Grand Tetons.
Oh, that's beautiful. Cool. I mean, it certainly you can see a lot of good mountains in this. Good looking movie for sure. As much as it is thought of as this Othello story, you know what it actually reminded me of was the story of Joseph and Potiphar from the Bible. I think it's a lot closer to that, right?
Yeah, there's some biblical overtones there.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's a familiar. I mean, the presence of Rod Steiger and the Pinky character makes it firmly like, okay, this is an Othello riff. But you know, it's not uncommon for like a younger man to like arrive at a place with a rich man and his younger wife, and for there to be some sort of tension over that. That's sort of a trope that can be done in a lot of different ways. You know, you can make any of those characters the perspective character. Very easily, you know, and it's just a natural dynamic. And yeah, in this one, the Glenn Ford character Jubal is certainly the one that they're most interested in. This is it also very reminiscent of Shane, I thought.
Yes,
Very of the era.
Drifter wanders into a family, and there's and attraction between him and the wife, and
yes, He's just sort of an innately good guy that everyone sort of responds to, even though he's very taciturn. And actually, that's the thing. Like every character in this movie has a very intense emotional relationship with Jubal, but he does not really reciprocate in a lot of ways.
Yeah, he's pretty stoic.
Yeah, but everyone projects a lot onto him. You know, he's Ernest Borgnine's best friend. What's the actress playing the wife?
Valerie French.
Yeah, she almost falls in love with him. Rod Steiger despises him. He does very little to inspire any of these reactions, just other than be his own, you know, kind of innately good guy self.
Rod Steiger develops a hatred of Jubal right off the bat.
Oh, yeah.
Just because he's an outsider and he smells of sheep dip, right?
Mm-hmm.
Smells of sheep dip.
Well, you get the sense that Steiger has a problem with just about everyone. And
right.
And as soon as Jubal becomes like a threat to his position or just his advancement, you know, that gets escalated and he becomes a focal point for him. But yeah, it's overblown, I guess, a little bit, to say the least. Yeah. So the movie begins with an interesting, you know, the kind of font and opening titles that we're quite used to at this point, which is just a lot of burlap and red paint kind of vibe. There's sort of a Disney vibe to this movie, I feel. Like, the aesthetic, the music, for example, the Jubal March, or whatever this is, it feels very bouncy and frontierlandish for the kind of, like, sexual drama that it ultimately ends up being. It's not a lot of action in Jubal.
No.
But it presents itself as kind of an adventure film, I would say.
Yeah, but it's not Disney-esque in its themes or treatment of its themes.
No, not at all. That's why it's so odd.
Yeah.
You got the Wonderful World of Disney opening credits here and the music, stuff like that. Jubal falls down a hill. That's the beginning of the movie. It feels like he's drunk. Is he drunk or is he
He's wiped out by the elements. He went through a blizzard and lost his horse and he's freezing.
Yeah, and Ernest Borgnine playing Shep Horgan, which is that's a real Ernest Borgnine character name, if ever there was one.
Shep Horgan.
Driving down the road on his wagon and just sees him like passed out on the road and just like, oh, I gotta take care of this guy and bring him home and feed him and all that because he's a real good guy, you know, he's a nice guy, rich rancher, which
one of the most beloved men in the valley is what Steiger keeps saying.
I mean, yeah, this is interesting. Like, this character type, this archetype, is usually the antagonist in these movies, and they go out of their way to make him beloved, and just a good guy. Everyone agrees what a good guy Shep is. So they take him back to the Spread, which is the name of his ranch, and immediately, you know, one of his ranch hands, Pinky, is riding him down, you know, like, oh, he smells like a sheep dip, as we've been saying. they actually have a great exchange right away, some very good Western dialogue immediately in Jubal, which is that whole thing, like, I've never heard of a cowboy who would ever lower himself to dealing with sheep, or something like that.
Yeah.
Nobody would ever do that. And then Jubal's like, yeah, show me who wouldn't when they're poor. And everyone's like, ooh.
Yeah, show me one, yeah.
Yeah, sure. And, you know, it's not enough just to take care of this guy. You know, Borgnine's got to, you know, take him in, give him a bed, give him clothes, and then when he wakes up, hey, why don't you have a job as well, you know? We got an opening position. Could you please come work for me here? And that gets Pinky's goat as well, and he burns his clothes overnight. I just couldn't abide that sheep smell. You know, and it's just... These characters are quickly drawn. You know, I wouldn't say they're deep characters in this film, per se. I mean, we're dealing with archetypes. You know, again, yeah. I think we talked about the Othello referencing. But you, even though these aren't the deepest characters, they are well explored and examined, I think. And that's always happening in every scene. You know, like... every time we see these characters, you know, they feel human, I guess. especially Shep's wife May, I think, is ultimately the most interesting character in the film, I believe. Very strange performance, and it really straddles a lot of different lines. You know, there's a lot of interesting archetypes here that they're using with this character, because she is unhappy in her marriage and has a wandering eye for Jubal. She's unfaithful, but you know, she's definitely not a villain. Like, she's not a bad guy in this.
Oh, she's a bit of a bitch.
She's not I think she is sympathetic. You know, she doesn't know what she wants, and she's not being faithful, you know, to Borgnine, which, you know, is cinematic language wise that means we're not supposed to like her, but, you know, she kind of seems to have some reasoning behind it, and
What's her reasoning, though? She made a bad choice.
Yeah, uh-huh. She made a bad choice. Yeah, uh-huh. When she was young, and she kind of just wanted to get out of the situation she was in as a younger person. And yeah, it's one of those female characters in a Western that seems to be kind of without options and just gets married off in a almost like as part of some sort of financial or a transactional nature. They don't really go into that, but
But I don't feel sympathetic toward her, because she made her choice on the basis of his wealth.
That's true.
On the basis of the man himself.
Yeah, she's certainly not a good guy, you know. And it's not the innocent Desdemona character either at all. Like this character is looking to get out of her relationship. She is looking for somebody else. She's looking to go into somebody else's arms, essentially. She used to hook up with Pinky, right? That's crazy.
That is crazy. I had a tough time with that. I really did.
Yeah. Uh huh. Yeah, I mean,
she must have been desperate.
Yeah, you know, yes, desperate. That is a good way to describe her. I mean, she has elements of the femme fatale for sure. I thought we were going for a thing where, like, we were going to go full noir in this, and she was going to be like, "I need you to help me kill him, Jubal." But you know, it never gets there. Like, And I mean, the movie also kind of, you know, pulls its punches a little in that regard, because Shep is just such a nice guy. Everyone loves Shep so much.
Pretty gullible.
But May used to hook up with Pinky, he is immediately suspicious of her relationship with Jubal as well, you know. So Pinky's a real just a porcine little asshole. I mean, he's just a nasty to everyone. He's covetous and just openly hostile and cruel. I love this character. I think this guy's great. he's so odious. It's a very repellent. You know, like one thing about Iago in Othello is that he's charismatic and he grabs the audience's attention and interest and. Because he's got these direct address monologues to them, and there's at least theatrical charisma to him. You know, he's an appealing character in that way. This guy is just ugly. This character is really despicable, and I like that very much. I was surprised to read that he was a problem for Delmar Daves and others. You know, like they didn't get what he was doing, because he's not. Not typically a Western actor, Rod Steiger.
You know, I was reading about the film a little bit and discovered that Rod Steiger had done the part of Marty in a teleplay.
What?
In 1953, yeah. And Ernest Borgnine got the role for the film and won an Academy Award for Marty in 1955.
Oh wow!
And I, I was wondering if there was any bad blood between them over that, because Rod Steiger wasn't selected for the film.
Huh. That's interesting. I mean, Ernest Borgnine as Marty is like that. That's the defining Ernest Borgnine role, really.
Right.
Yeah, he got the Oscar for it and everything.
Yep.
And that's that. I think that is also, that was like right before this, as you were saying. He takes a lot of that energy into that sort of like you know, sympathetic sad sack kind of energy into this, even though he's more, you know, gregarious in this, obviously, but. Right. But he's also, you know, cuckolded. He's, you know, he's a sort of sympathetic guy, which is never the Ernest Borgnine that I knew growing up. It was kind of interesting to see him later, because I always, you know, I always thought of him as the Viking chief from the
Ragnar.
Vikings.
Yeah,
yeah, that's right. His more broad characterizations, I guess.
He was great as Ragnar, too.
He is great as Ragnar. Ragnar is awesome. That movie's a lot of fun. I got to see that again.
Yeah. Odin.
You know, my problem with that movie is that I'm way more into the Vikings than I am into Tony Curtis and his whole story. I'm just like, I don't care about Tony Curtis.
I think that's universal.
Yeah.
Gotta be universal.
Mm-hmm. I wish Kirk Douglas was the protagonist of that film.
Yep.
He basically is, anyway. that's a fun movie, though, Vikings. With man, I just remember Ernest Borgnine jumping into a pit full of wolves. That's my favorite scene. yeah.
Not the braid cutting scene?
It doesn't be jumping into a pit of wolves. No. Okay, so Pinky hates that May is clearly infatuated with Jubal, and well, he hates everything. Like, there's nothing that happens that Pinky doesn't hate, basically.
Right.
Why do people put up with him?
Well, that's what I kept asking myself.
Yeah.
And Shep particularly, you know? I mean, he's such a good-natured guy. Why does he put up with such a sourpuss and such an evil bastard?
Yeah, just a toad of a man. And you know, because he knows how to be a ranch hand is essentially what you get. You know, not enough to
he's
make him a
top hand. Yeah, top hand.
Yeah. And yeah, he does indeed offer Jubal the foreman position, you know, like kind of out of the blue, but like way over, like just diving right over Pinky. Just,
yep.
Yeah, and that's a real snub.
doesn't sit too well with Pinky.
Of course it doesn't. and yeah, he's also like a very oblivious guy when it comes to his wife. Like, super
doesn't pick up on the signs at all.
No, and they are crystal clear. They, you know, she is making her displeasure with him very evident. You know, he like come up behind her and give her a back massage. Like, ah, my little girl, ah, my darling, ah, and she's just like,
well, he treats her like a possession.
Oh yeah, yeah.
You know,
well, I don't think it's even that. Like there's. There's treating a girl like a possession, and there's like putting her on a pedestal, you know, and venerating her in a way that is sort of, you know, that he's just graceless, you know, like he's not being an asshole, so to speak. He's just sort of doesn't know what to do or how to treat women, you know, right. At all, really, or you know, he doesn't know how to interact with them, I guess, you know, her perspective on it is very much that, you know, that yeah, he's just
well,
a, he's
just like
a
some kind
beast.
Of dance hall girl.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
You know?
Yes, essentially. like, so it's like, hey, Jubal, why don't you dance with my wife while I play this piano? You know? I'm going to leave you two alone for a while, okay? See ya. I just, like, no idea. Completely ignorant. And she is very much into Jubal. Like, she is going for it. She wants to have an affair with Jubal. And he is never tempted for a moment in this whole film. This is completely outside of him, you know? Like,
right.
He couldn't be more clear. He's like, no, I'm not into it. I'm a good friend of your husband's. I'm no. And yeah, she's just open mouth kissing him, and he's like, "What are you doing? This, we're stopping this before it begins. Come on, what do you?" what do you think of Glenn Ford as Jubal in this?
He's a little too stoic, I think.
I agree. I like Glenn Ford a lot, actually. I loved him in 3:10 to Yuma. I thought that role suited him a little bit better, maybe. Yeah. He's doing like a Randolph Scott thing, or I guess Shane would be the obvious, like, you know. Like that's the performance they want here. They want Alan.
Well, he's doing the tight-lipped hero.
Yeah,
you know, and it can only go so far. And
mm-hmm. Yes,
his relationship with the girl and what are they, Mennonites or Quakers or something?
You know, they're Mormons? Episcopalians of some kind. Yeah. Uh huh. They're, you know, traveling religious folk. Yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
That relationship is kind of weird.
I like that. I like that, actually. I think it's effective that he finally starts talking to her, you know, after not talking to anybody really the whole film.
Well, we do get his backstory that way.
Yeah, uh-huh. And even he's just like, I don't even know why I'm saying all this. it's weird to him that he's opening up to somebody. That's a good scene, I think. You know, the girl is whatever, nothing. But like,
well, I guess that's what I meant. She doesn't have much of a role.
No, it's odd that he gravitates toward her as a character. But I mean, maybe it's just that, you know, maybe he just needs somebody. And well, you know, I don't know. There's nothing going on with Naomi, to be honest. I Glenn Ford makes that relationship work, I think.
But you think he's a little too stoic as well, huh?
I do. I like him. I like him, but I don't know. I don't think he's a natural fit for this. I think he's got a little bit more, just going off of 3:10. Like, that character is more successful, I would say, because he's got a bit of a twinkle in his eye. He's got, a bit more menace, a bit more jovial, a bit more everything, really. Like, just a little bit more everything in that movie. And this, it feels like he's putting the thing on a little bit. Like, he's got good scenes, and I like him again, but yeah, it's, you know, it doesn't work quite in that Alan Ladd way. Put it that way. You know? It's a tough role. Like, John Wayne couldn't have done this very well, I think. It's this sort of stoic, taciturn hero is, you know, it's familiar, but it's not so easy to pull off, really.
Randolph Scott did it in almost every film.
Randolph Scott could totally have played this character. That totally would have worked. I don't know. He wasn't a big sexual chemistry kind of guy, Randolph Scott. But no. I guess that's kind of what makes this character a little bit. A little bit more, a little bit unusual, is that he has these intimate relationships, despite being a stoic drifter that isn't really supposed to have those. He has one with everyone. Like, he's accepting his role as foreman, you know, of Shep's, you know, sort of second in command, and he's doing a good job of it, much to Pinky's dismay. There's a part where Pinky almost shoots his head off. That's pretty good.
Right.
I thought it was a mountain lion I saw. You know, I'm like.
Glenn Ford comes back with a pistol shot, right?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
To the tree right next to Pinky and says, "Yeah, I understand."
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's. Like, why are they keeping this guy around? and this is about where we get those pilgrims. Because they come on to Shep's land to stay for a little while they tend to some sick and wounded people. And Pinky tries to run him off the land. Pinky's like, oh, you're going to have to move on. I'm doing so much Rod Steiger.
Go ahead. You got a good Rod Steiger.
Yeah, you don't belong here. You're going to get off this land now. And yeah, he's just a nasty guy, of course. And yeah, this is just exerting power, you know. And then Jubal rides up and he's like, whoa, what are you doing here? Come on, they can just hang out, right? It's fine.
What have they done? They haven't done anything.
Yeah. At which point, Charles Bronson just rides into the film. He's like, hey. Yeah, you can trust these pilgrims here, Jubal. Trust me. He just shows up and he's just like, "Yep, Charles Bronson, I'm going to be here to help you, Jubal." And in this case, I'll vouch for the pilgrims. What is this character's name?
Reb.
Red.
They call him Reb. Reb.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is a neat little early Charles Bronson performance, huh? This is
pre-Magnificent Seven, right?
Yeah, it would be. Uh-huh. I guess this is when he was, you know, he was very young.
On his way up.
Yeah. And yeah, he ends up just being a sort of a sidekick to Jubal for the rest of this film. It's pretty great. So they come into conflict over this. And Pinky, in order to better run Jubal down when he is explaining the situation, keeps telling everyone, I think the only reason that Jubal wanted to help him was because he had eyes for that pretty young girl. And, he's trying to make that a bad thing,
yeah.
Yes, uh-huh. But what he ends up doing is kind of forcing them together in a way. Like everyone's like super happy about it. It's like, oh, Jubal met a girl? That's great. Oh, Jubal, tell me about that girl you met. I hear you got eyes with that young lady with the pilgrims. And
that young filly.
Yes, that young
filly. She's called a filly.
It's And yeah, she ends up being his girlfriend, essentially. Because of Pinky here. So May, and this is sort of where we're getting into her and Shep's relationship a little bit more. She has her speech here, which we've kind of touched on, you know.
Why she ended up in Wyoming?
Yeah, uh-huh. And this is I think I wrote in my notes here. Is she maybe the bad guy? She has a speech to justify her, you know, her resentment, and she admits to wanting Shep to die, you know, and it seems like everyone does kind of treat her as this, you know, this sex object. I guess you would say, for lack of a better phrase, that's who she is in this world, you know, and everyone kind of sees her in that way, except Jubal, really, you know.
Well, he probably sees her that way too, but has the wherewithal to withstand the temptation.
Yeah, I mean, he doesn't seem tempted at all, is the thing. Like, I mean, maybe he's just that good a guy, but he's, you know, he doesn't seem to want to even speak to her, frankly, you know.
I always felt that he could have been a little more forceful. I mean, that's part of his stoicism, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But he could have been a little more forceful in his denial of her.
He could have, affections. Yes. I think, if I'm guessing, it was, you know, it's certainly not that he's, like, into it at all. He's certainly not, you know, tempted. I think it's more just like, I don't want to make a big thing out of this. Maybe we could just, you know, move on and this won't be a thing. You know, that'd be okay, right? You know?
Yeah.
You know, he certainly doesn't want to bring it up to Shep. You know, he doesn't want to, you know, be a cause for any trouble between them. And There's a scene like shortly after this where Shep asks Jubal for woman advice. You know, he's just like, "Oh, well, you think you could tell me what do you know about women, Jubal? I can't seem to make her happy." This is the first time he's acknowledged that she seems very unhappy, yeah. And it's kind of a big scene, actually, a really good scene. He's very noncommittal in wanting to talk about this at all. You know, Jubal's just like, "Well, you know, maybe you don't." Maybe don't pat her on the rump. Yeah, girls don't like that. Yeah. and Jubal, of course, is got this relationship sort of building with this pilgrim girl that everyone's pressured him into. And and this is where, yeah, like, this is where he opens up finally. He kind of gets fed up with the goings-on with the Borgnine and his wife and just rides out to talk to her. And we get the whole Jubal backstory here, which is, you know, that he was like sort of some light of child abuse growing up. His mother resented him being born and did not love him. There's a pretty powerful, I don't know, intense, I guess would be a better way of putting it, story about her watching
how his father died. How
his father died, which was saving him from drowning and getting chopped up by a boat propeller. Something like that.
Yeah. I'm wondering about a propeller, though.
It's a little strange.
Did they have propellers? They had paddle wheels, but...
He definitely... Definitely talk about a propeller.
He said propeller, yeah.
Yeah, I know that would be like an outboard motor would be what was in my head, which they did not have in the Old West. And his mom just watched it happen, wanted him to die, and you know, and then you know immediately after, it should have been you, Jubal, you know, and so
yeah,
and yeah. This again is, this is something you see a lot too. This loner character is really charismatic. Like he really draws people to him a lot for being a loner who doesn't talk to people if he can avoid it, doesn't know how to interact with people. Everyone seems to really be drawn to him anyway.
Right.
Is this his innate goodness? Is this, do you think?
Well, he thinks he's bad luck.
Yeah. Uh huh. Yeah, he does.
He thinks he attracts bad luck.
Mm-hmm. Which maybe he does, based on what is going on in this movie. that's who he is, and that's why he was a mess in the beginning of the film. Why he was wandering around, what that was all about. So the pilgrims are leaving at this point. You know, they've recuperated, they're on their way out, because they want to get off of, you know, Shep's land. Oh, by the way, the leader of these pilgrims, the older, you know, the elder who's talking to them, you know, sort of the...
Yeah, Basil Rousdale, yeah.
Oh, wow. Good job. what's Basil Rousdale from?
I don't know. I've seen him in so much stuff, I couldn't give you the title.
Oh, okay, just some studio character actor guy, but he worked a lot. Okay, fair enough. I think this is real dumb. This character is named Shemp.
Shemp?
That sucks. Yeah,
that's Basil like one of the Three Stooges, character. Right?
Yes, it's Shemp from the Three Stooges. Also, it's almost Shep.
Almost Shep, yeah.
That's dumb. That sucks. I was thrown a few times before I realized that character was named Shemp. It's like, why would they tell Shep that? Oh, it's that guy. Okay.
Shemp.
Yeah, that's an unforced error, Jubal. That's what. Not a problem that you needed. I figure that it seems like the pilgrims are leaving the film at this point, but it seems clear, like, oh no, she's the girl that he's into, and so they'll continue to be a thing. And they are, ultimately, of course. So, I guess this takes us basically into Act 3 in the real Othello of it all. You know, the which is, you know, where stuff starts to go down.
Yep.
Yeah. They're out on the range working. You know, they're
roundup time. Yeah.
Yeah. They're you know, this is all the guys. They're, you know, out on open fire, playing cards, spending the night out on the plain, and May rides out from camp. I guess just to stir shit up, you know, as far as I can tell.
Yeah, that was pretty much my assessment of it.
Yeah.
Stir shit up, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, Pinky at this point notices a shared glance between Jubal and May, and that's all it takes, you know. Just them looking at each other with maybe communicating something, or maybe just looking at each other a little bit long. And he decides what he's gonna do right away. And yeah, so May wants to head back, and you know, Borgnine of course is like, oh no, you need an escort back because you're a fragile woman folk of some kind.
Oh, we got mountain lions out there.
Mountain lions, yeah. Why doesn't Jubal take you back? Jubal, you drive my wife back, and you know.
Clueless.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, I mean, that's his flaw—is just being dumb, right? I mean, like, just oblivious and in his own
gullible
head, you know.
Yeah.
Which is not really Othello-ish, I gotta say.
Right.
For being the Othello character, he's the least. He has the least screen time and the least least to do. Ernest Borgnine, I would say.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, so once they're gone, you know, Pinky goes full Iago, and May knows that Jubal doesn't play cards. What do you think she came out here for? And ships.
Think
by
about
it.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
Jubal, May, together.
It's interesting the way they communicate this in a 1956 film. It's all implication. There's a lot of implication in this movie. Very little nailing down what we're talking about. This is something I noticed. Like, it's all very, you know, like, I'm just going to dance over what I mean here. And you
well,
can
which
kind
leads, of... Which leads to a lot of misunderstanding.
Yes. Uh-huh. Yeah.
Yep.
But I wonder if it isn't also studio code stuff, you know? Like, for being a sexual melodrama, which this definitely is, there's no talk of sex. There's certainly no, you know, I mean, it gets no more risque than a kiss. But it's all about, you know, sexual obsession and fidelity and power, basically.
Infidelity. Yeah.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And, And yeah, that's not really a thing. It's not a sexy movie at all, per se, though.
No.
Yeah. Anyway.
May tries to make it.
Do you think?
A little bit.
It might be changing times, you know. This film is, of course, you know, 60 years old at this point. This is...
Yeah. Jeez.
Yeah. Anyway, Shep buys it all. I mean, kind of. He's like, he punches Rod Steiger. You know, he's got some crazy eyes going on. He's just like, anyone tell me that he's wrong. Tell me he's lying. Which, you know, it's tough to prove a negative, you know.
Yeah.
He doesn't have his head around him at all. Like, he's, you know.
Well, the Noah Beery character does say, of course he's lying. You know? But Ernest Borgnine is already gone off the deep end.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, he's already decided that Jubal's, you know, doing something untoward with his wife.
Yeah, it's like a red sheet in front of a bull's eyes, you know, kind of thing. He's,
right.
And indeed, this escalates quite quickly. I did not expect this to go down as fast as it does. Yeah, because Jubal's at a bar, you know, like he's spurned May's advances one more time, and rather than riding straight back, he goes to a bar, you know, to get a little bit drunk, because, you know, because he's sad about the whole situation. So he's drinking with Charles Bronson, he's talking about how he's a curse, you know, and then Shep shows up, starts shooting up the bar, and Jubal kills him. Whoa. I didn't expect that.
Well, they had that nifty thing they'd been practicing, right? Where Charles Bronson tosses him a gun.
Right, yeah.
And he shoots.
Yeah.
Because Jubal was unarmed.
Yeah. And then, you know, they're in a situation where it's like, you all saw what happened. He had no choice. You know, one of those things. But he's still got to get out of there. Because, you know, because everyone loves Shep. Shep's the most popular man in town. He's a real fezziwig. Yeah. You know, it's...
He's a fezziwig.
Yeah. He is. He's a fezziwig.
He is.
You were doing something you shouldn't with my wife, Scrooge. Stupid. Okay. So, Pinky, of course, you know, being just a weasel, just a weasel that he is, you know, is going to take advantage of this situation, you know. And he has some, you know, he immediately has some piece of guilt and blame over this that is obvious to anybody who saw it go down. But he's just like, oh, no. It's all at Jubal, you know. He was planning this from the beginning, you know. And, like, he's getting May involved in it, you know. He's gonna do everything he can to pin the entire blame on this on Jubal. And his first move is to go meet May and let her know that what happened. And and he becomes real gross and threatening immediately, you know. Mm-hmm. Sits in Shep's chair. She's like, "Oh no, honey! From now on, this here's my chair." And ultimately, beats her up, like beats her to the point of death. Here, which happens off camera.
Yeah, which I never quite figured out what was her purpose in running to the barn. You know,
I mean, well, she's just like, oh, I can't believe it happened. Oh,
just trying to get away from him, I guess. But
my female,
she goes running, you know, to the barn.
Yeah, and he follows her in, and I mean, is he intend to kill her here?
Well, I don't
or does
think
he intend
to
scare her so much that she'll blame Jubal? Is that his move?
Good question.
Because, I mean, I guess if he meant to kill her, he would kill her. Outright.
Well, he thought he had.
Okay. Yes, that's right.
Mm-hmm. He thought he had.
And he's going to blame that on Jubal. That was the move. Right. Yes. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a little convenient that he didn't then. But still, that's fine. Okay. And yeah, he gathers a posse together, you know, and he's got a big old bad guy speech about how, you know, Jubal's not one of us, and we you know what to do to him. We gotta hang him. And he's such a good bad guy. He's such a sleaze bag in this. Despicable. He's great.
I think he's even more despicable than Dr. Zhivago.
Rod Steiger's a very good bad guy. Always is. He's even kind of hateful when he's not playing a bad guy. He's so yeah, Jubal wants to, you know, he's boarding with the pilgrims, and there's a very good scene when, you know, they decide to take him in while the posse's looking for him, because, you know, because he took care of them back in the day. And, you know, this is where Charles Bronson has a lot to do in these scenes, actually. He's you know, kind of making the arguments for Jubal that Jubal himself doesn't want to make, I guess you'd say. And yeah, I mean, it all comes down to they head over to back to Borgnine's ranch. You know, all parties involved end up there. You know, Pinky leads the posse there so he can show them what happened to May, and yeah, and yeah, oh yeah, and they're they Jubal tells him to meet there too, right?
Yeah, he says have him go to the ranch.
Yeah, how did he know?
Because he wants to get the truth out of May.
Oh right, he wants May to vouch for him as well. Right. Yes. Uh-huh. And yeah, so Bronson, you know, comes up and he's like, yeah, you know, if he ain't there, you can hang me in his place, which, you know, wow, going all in. And, because people love Jubal. Everyone loves Jubal. They're all willing to lay down for Jubal. It's very, you know, he's a good guy. And he gets people on his side. Or maybe they just don't like Pinky that much, but, yeah, and now May kind of has a redemptive death scene, you know, at the barn.
Right.
Wants to be, you know, straight up with everyone, tell them what happened.
Well, they all arrive, and Jubal manages to get to her before she dies.
Yes, fortunately. Right? Real fortunately, I'd say.
Truth, and, mm-hmm. and then all of the posse arrives.
Yeah.
And the first thing that that Jubal does is have the doctor go see May.
Yeah.
Which was fortuitous because
she sure got is.
Her last words.
Because she's got 30 seconds left of life. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's very unclear what happened between Pinky and May at this point. And it's a 1950s thing maybe, but the extent of what happened there is left very much to the imagination, which... I saw some reviews say is effective, but it's sort of curious, I think, more than anything.
Some of the reviews I read assume that there was rape involved.
It's an assumption, but yeah, I mean, it seems certainly possible. Certainly that would fit with Pinky's MO, you know, and right. He is a spurned ex-lover, which I still can't get over that they were hooking up.
I know. Who the hell would hook up with...
Yeah, well, certainly not her. I mean, I guess she's that desperate. Yeah. Like, that's not like... that. At best, a lateral move from Ernest Borgnine. Probably a lot worse, considering the guy's nature. Yeah. So, we get a brief moment of Jubal getting to beat up Pinky a little bit, which is just like, yeah, good, finally, you know? Yeah, this is after we find out May died, and she said, and it was Pinky that did all the bad things, dead. And then, then you know, yeah, he had a bit of an ass beating, and then they just, like, leave. And there is a heavy implication that Pinky is hung.
They surround him with their horses. He's lying on the ground, and they surround him with their horses.
Yeah. And then the camera pans up to a hook that is hanging from the barn rafter. Yeah. Uh-huh. And I don't know. I honestly, maybe it's, I you know, it's in keeping with that, that you know, the 1950s studio vibe of this, but I think that this implication and stuff that is going on in the last 10 minutes of this movie, I think it's just noticeable in a way that doesn't help necessarily. I get it's the aesthetic, but nah.
They gotta wrap it up, and they do it too abruptly.
Yes, it is a very, very abrupt ending to this. And then, yeah, like as this group is descending on Pinky, Jubal and Naomi and Charles Bronson, the third wheel, just ride off together. And yep. And they're just like, yep, we're gonna go off together and hang out, I guess, you know.
That's the end.
Yeah, you know, whatever's going on with him and Naomi is not resolved. I assume they get together at this point, but it's not, you know, they don't address those problems or issues. I mean,
nope, we're left, knowing we're led, smiles.
No one knows what happens to the ranch. No one knows, you know, who takes over or if all those guys still have a job or is it Jubal's now? You know, none of that is addressed. It's just like, and credits, that's the end. Everyone's dead, who's going to die? And there you go. And yeah, you know. It's not a terrific ending. It feels like it pulls its punches a little to me, even though, you know, it's clear enough what they're going for. But it's the right narratively ending. I would say. What's that?
It's the right narrative ending?
Yeah, the things that happen are the correct things. It just feels like...
Which is a standard studio ending.
Yeah, you know. It just doesn't quite get there. And I mean, honestly, if you're going to be... If you're going to go for it and really do Othello, you know, like have this be a tragedy in some sense. I was prepared for maybe a downbeat ending, you know, if this is going to be a
well, if it's like Othello, then Ernest Borgnine would have ended up killing May.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
He was too nice a guy for that.
That's true. Yeah. It couldn't really be Othello. It's about the Michael Cassio character, Jubal, rather than these other guys. And right. I think it does get into Jubal's head. I really like Jubal as portrayed in this film. I like Glenn Ford. Like we said, a little maybe too taciturn, but I like this movie very much, actually. I want to say 4 stars. I want to say 4 stars out of 5.
That's what I was going to give it.
Mm-hmm. I was very pleased with this. It's a good movie. It's I think I like 3:10 a bit more. I think it's a little bit more, you know, a little bit more fully realized as a film. But they're both really good. Delmer Daves is really good. Terrific director.
Uh-huh. Does a good job.
He's done some other stuff that I would also be happy to watch for this. And
Arrow? He did Broken Arrow,
that's
too,
the big other one, yeah, which apparently was one of the first to sympathetically portray Native Americans. So that would be a cool one to watch, too, at some point.
Yeah.
Another
Jimmy Stewart.
4 out of 5, then, Dad?
Yep.
All right. I mean, I guess that would be Jubal. Do you have any further thoughts on it?
No, I was really pleased to watch it in the Blu-ray. It was a different film almost.
Oh, okay.
It was that marked.
God, I love a good Blu-ray. I love a good Blu-ray. It's of an older film. There's nothing better.
Yeah, no, it was great.
I got a couple 70s movies.
The sound was good.
Alien and Jaws. I've got Blu-rays of those. They look like they were filmed this year. It's amazing.
Wow.
Like Jaws looking like a 2017 film. That's really cool. God,
Jaws
great.
Is great.
Yeah.
I got that on Blu-ray as well.
Yeah, that's my favorite one. So, what else have you been watching, Dad? What else going on?
What else have I been watching? Let's see. Bunch of westerns.
Oh yeah? Well, that's perfect for this show that we're doing on westerns, Dad. What was the standout?
Well, there was one with Audie Murphy that wasn't too bad, Gunpoint. I'm trying to remember now.
All right.
He was, and then there was Fort Petticoat. I watched a bunch of crap too. A lot of TV westerns.
Okay.
So there's a routine that I get into sometimes when I get home from work. I'll sit and watch Cheyenne, Laramie. let's see, what is it? Death Valley Days, a couple of those. Tales of Wells Fargo.
Yeah. Tales from Wells Fargo. What is that? It's not, I would imagine
Dale
it's
Robertson.
About the bank.
Tales of Wells Fargo. You know, they're all half-hour westerns. Cheyenne's an hour, I think.
Yeah.
Every once in a while, I'll stick out an episode of The Virginian, which is like 90 minutes.
Mm-hmm. The Virginian?
But, I haven't seen many... I haven't seen any movies in the theater recently.
Oh, have I seen any good movies in the theater recently? Not really.
I'm kind of interested in seeing The Murder on the Orient Express, the new one.
I am so going to go see that. I'm excited for that. I'm very excited for that.
Kenneth Branagh looks like a great Poirot.
He looks fun, huh? That mustache, that looks like a blast.
Yeah.
I would love it if they started making more, you know, all-star murder mysteries. That would be fun, you know. It's like, which of these movie stars did it? You know, that's great. let's see. I'm trying to think if I've seen anything interesting of late. And not really. Me and Amanda have been watching the new season of Stranger Things. Did you ever do Stranger Things, Dad?
No, Annie recommended that, and I haven't done it yet.
It's a lot of fun. Give it a go. It's
great.
It's very atmospheric and well shot and well composed, and it's neat. It's very much, it's like 80s, 80s stuff. Okay. Here's my Stranger Things deal. Do you remember, like, when I was a kid and we watched Nick at Night a lot and, you know, a lot of 1950s sitcoms, the Ozzie and Harriet, Leave It to Beaver, all of those. And they sort of fetishized the 1950s in a way, you know, like that they became very, you know, like this was, you know what did this very much? Happy Days. Or American Graffiti, where it became very easy to have a shorthand for what the 1950s were. Sock hops and rock and roll and, going to going to the phosphate shop and,
right.
Poodle skirts.
Hanging out at the malt shop.
Grease did this. You know, like these, this was, right. And this was a very, I had a very, like, distinct idea of what the 1950s were as a child without having ever, you know, being nowhere near that. And it became a symbol of a specific time, you know, like basically my parents' childhoods, you know, I would say. And I think that that's happening with the 1980s now. I think that is becoming fetishized in that same way. In a very specific Gen X way now, you know, because it is now my childhood that is being reproduced by all this stuff that is modern, you know, like It, the new It movie did the exact same thing, which is one of the major influences on Stranger Things. It feels very much like Spielberg kind of suburban kids, you know, and there's an element of the mystical, or Stephen King, you know, it's very Stephen King / Steven Spielberg, the whole series. There's a synthesizer score that is incredible. The music in it is absolutely great. And you know, there's elements of all sorts of 1980s films. Most obvious would be like E.T. or Close Encounters, or, you know, any of those sort of family sci-fi kind of things that were so popular back then. And then or Gremlins. There's some Gremlins related stuff in the new season. There's a scene where the kids all dress up, kids in like middle school, they dress up as Ghostbusters for Halloween, you know, stuff like that.
Ghostbuster.
I was, yeah. So it's, I think you would actually really dig it, Dad, on the basis of all this. So I recommend Stranger Things to you. Check it out.
All right.
Yeah, it's very good. Very good. And
that's on Netflix, right?
Oh, exclusively. Yes. Yeah. Okay, so for the next episode of Westerns with Dad, which we'll be doing in 2 weeks' time, we're going to talk about Dead Man. This is a 1990s Western, black and white, starring Johnny Depp. It's going to be a weird one. One that has been recommended to us through emails. Thanks again for Ron for recommending Jubal. Thank you, Ron. I believe this was back in April when we first got this. We're getting to it now. if you would like to recommend a movie for us to talk about on this show, we're going to be doing more and more of those. That's that phone call you need to take. Okay, you take that, and I'll finish this out here. Say thing now. Say adios, amigos, now.
Adios, amigos.
All right, cool. You take that, and I'll finish this off. So what we're going to do is, if you want to reach us online, westernsadad@gmail.com. You can reach us on iTunes, and please leave reviews and ratings for us there. And, you can hit back episodes that have bounced off the iTunes page on our website, westernswithdad.com. That's all there is to it. Okay, so thank you very much, and we'll see you next time when we talk about Dead Man. Take care.
Mm-hmm.